I'd like to tell you about a common dysfunction that some of you will have read about. And it starts like this. The team is in trouble. Someone steps up and says, I'll save you! And single-handedly fights all the wars and slays all the dragons and finally gets kind of tired and either walks away or gets ill and has to take leave or burns out or quietly shifts to another role inside that same group. And now you have this vacuum of leadership. And what happens is somebody else will just step in to fill it. Kent Beck calls this the hero shithead roller coaster. It comes from his series of talks called Ease at Work. And you can find a link to that in the notes at the back. There are other names for this pattern. Roger Martin, the dean of Rotman Business School in Toronto, has called it the responsibility virus, and it's catchy. So when this guy gets cut down to size or removes himself from the picture and says, you never listen to me, you don't appreciate me, and walks away, somebody else will just step in. It's a virus, and it catches, and you can affect what's going on in the culture of your team by changing how you look at your work and letting something else be contagious. It's also called the great man theory of management. Special people need to be leaders. We say everyone on a team can be a leader. It's a paradigm shift. Some people say you need to be born a leader. We say that there are skills that you can learn that you will help you bring leadership to your team. Now, I'm not saying that agile is the only way to work. In fact, in 1993, IBM published a study in which they revealed the results of what they had found in their organization about productivity. And they had found that within their organization, the type of team that had the greatest productivity was what they called a surgical model team. And the surgical team has a visionary who has an idea and needs to flesh it out. This person has the architecture, the design, the vision, everything in their head. You've probably seen this in small organizations and startups. And they just make it happen. They find the people they need, they tell them what needs to be done, and they get them to the goal. And it works. There are challenges, though. Now, that was 1993. Things have changed. There's a model we use in weather forecasting. We meteorologists. There's a model we use in reading the weather forecast. Talks about the cone of uncertainty and the fact that the cone of uncertainty is not so big tomorrow. It's not so big in 3 days. But in 30 days, we are really seriously guessing about what will happen at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on that day. And you know when you're packing for a trip, you probably want to include some options if your trip is a month away and you need to pack now. So we talk about the horizon of predictability, and the horizon of predictability is pulled in as business has got more complex. And we have less time to make mistakes, to make decisions, and to learn what the market needs. Those who are able to respond more quickly are the ones who can shift and follow the market or even lead the market. So things have sped up. Instead of having many months or a year to figure out what we're doing with a product, the horizon of predictability, the area in which it's sensible to plan, has pulled in much closer. Another thing has changed, which is that we've automated a lot of boring work, the stuff that's repetitive, the stuff that isn't interesting. What it's left us with is the fun stuff, which turns out to be making a lot of real-time decisions and incorporating a lot of new information all the time. We call it knowledge work. It really depends on what's between the ears of the people inside our organization. It's what IT people generally do, what software developers generally do right now. And with this kind of work, you've got a lot of complexity. So first you've got all those relationships that need to communicate with one another. And that's just a team of five. Imagine the number of arrows you've got on there if you've got 10 people in that team. They've all got to speak with leadership in the organization, yet more flows of information back and forth. Real-time information is coming in that's informing their decision-making from other parts of the organization, because although in Scrum we say that we protect the team, that doesn't mean that we ignore the fact that there is stuff going on outside that impacts us. And because there's real-time information coming in, decisions are being made that change previous decisions, and you need a lot of feedback mechanisms, and again, dealing with management in the organization. And with all of these flows, it starts to look quite chaotic. How do we lead on the edge of chaos? There isn't a surgeon for this situation. The mental models that we have seriously influence our outcomes. And this is a mental model that when we get into very chaotic situations, we may have in our mind without realizing it. I can hang on. We can make it to the end. It's binary, right? You're either still attached or you're not. This is just another form of the hero shithead roller coaster. How's it helpful to us? There's another model that comes to us from Owen Harrison, who is the creator of Open Space. How many of you have been in an Open Space conference? Great. Some of you will have the opportunity to try that out tomorrow. For 20 years, might even be 25, he's been doing Open Space conferences. He came up with this over two martinis at a conference where he was speaking with somebody and they said, you know, the best part of the conference is really the coffee breaks. So they designed a way to have a conference that was all coffee breaks, which is where those interesting conversations start to happen accidentally because you meet somebody who has interests that are either similar to yours or they're orthogonal, but they really lend something to what you're talking about.
So was it coffee break or martini breaks?
Depends on the person.
Whatever works.
Whatever works for you.
We have something called the law of 2 feet, and if it takes you to the bar, that's okay. Hopefully it takes you away from the bar a little later. So his model that he suggests after 20 years of doing like 10,000 experiments with open space, he says, how do we apply this to business? And he calls his model the Wave Rider. And his contention is that there is so much information in our lives. There's so much information coming in and going out and out there that we need to know about. We do not actually process all of it. So, for example, you're having a dinner party and you need to get to work early for a meeting and you know that there's shopping to be done and you carry all of these things with you, but you're not aware of all of them all the time. And then your spouse calls and says your daughter's really ill and has gone to the hospital. And you reorganize everything. And it works. And nobody's going to panic because you've taken your priorities and done what you've needed to do. And you'll figure out tomorrow, and things will move on. You're surfing. We do it all the time. We're all surfing all this information that we have and making the right decisions at the right time. Sometimes we make mistakes. I mean, we just say, that's life, right? It really is life, and it should be work as well. So his concept of open space is this very simple kind of a conference where people arrive and there is no agenda, and together they create an agenda. And the only thing that goes on the agenda is something that they're passionate about or something that they're intensely curious about and don't have an answer for. They create the agenda together at the beginning of the day, and then they run their meetings. Whoever wants to come will be there. Whoever isn't interested will stay away, and it'll be a better meeting because of it. As a facilitator, and I've heard this from other facilitators, just before you run an open space, there's always this moment of doubt. How on earth is this going to work? Because it's so darn simple, but it works. My husband's here, and I stole this book on the train when we were traveling to Berlin this spring. And he was sleeping, so stole this book, started to read it. Wow, this is a great book. And I was thinking about this talk, actually. I was planning this talk. It was the book Wave Rider by Harrison Owen. And I read for a while. I woke him up. I said, what if we just let anybody go to any meeting? We just made all our meetings open at work. What would happen? And I won't go further because he'll tell you in his Pecha Kucha what kind of workplace that makes. But this is taking open space, which was meant as a conference tool, and bringing it into the workplace. Making room for and inviting self-organization to generate what's needed here and what's needed now by these people. Not some best practice from somewhere else, but what we need now. This is the book that I'm talking about. So here's that image of the Wave Rider. And whether you're on top of the wave or you miss your cue and you end up in the wave, notice that you're still being pushed by the water. You still have the opportunity to get back up and do it again. Owen says we're all wave riders. We need to remember that. We need to incorporate that into our work. So when you're looking at your requirements, whether they look like that or they look like that, Remember that it is still just a model of reality. Not everything is in either of those forms of requirements. You know it in your gut. The customer knows it in their gut. These are models. These are mental models we use to talk to one another. You're surfing them. And you know you are. We need to remember that and decide just how little information we can function with in order to surf well. So, we have this metaphor, and we have another one. You have an opportunity to think about changing your metaphor for how you are dealing with change and information and moving forward at work. So let's look at the change agent role. The change agent is there to facilitate the creation of a learning organization. And we're really good at single loop learning, which is not necessarily a learning organization. Single loop learning is we do something, we say, oh, I can improve on that. Then we do it again, and we say, oh, yeah, I can improve on that too. And I think a lot of you in this room probably have engineering degrees. And you're probably really good at that. Not only by inclination, but also by training and by habit. But double loop learning says, let's step back. And beyond the thing that we're actually doing, let's remember why we're doing this and look at whether what we're doing actually reinforces and moves us toward the goal that we have together. We call it sometimes reflection. And that one's harder because when you're under pressure, this is the first thing that you're likely to want to cut. Single loop learning is about doing things right, getting it right, doing it right. Double loop learning is about doing the right things. You can have the most tightly tuned continuous integration process in the company and still lose your job if the company can't sell the software. Happened to me. It was great in the end. So do we need to make our work more efficient? This is for repeatable processes and for machines. Or do we want to make it more effective? We don't have time. It would be great if we could make it completely efficient. But with that horizon of predictability that's pulled in, we really need to make sure that we're doing the right things now because we don't have all the time that we used to have to make things efficient. And it turns out you don't have to be 100% efficient to still be effective. One of the main places that we implement double loop learning is in a formalized process we call retrospectives. I have strong opinions about retrospectives. And I suggest that if you only do one agile practice, do retrospectives. I know I'm not alone in saying this. Every coach I've talked to in the last 6 months has agreed with me on that. Do retrospectives. Deliver software and do retrospectives. And keep doing that again and again. And it will pull out other practices and show you where you need to apply other practices. There are resources to help you do this. The Norm Kurth book was written before he was involved with Agile teams, and so it's based on traditional long project timelines. And for doing, for example, at the end as a postmortem. But the exercises in it are excellent, and he includes a lot of writing about why we do these things the way we do and how we do them to create safety for the team. It's an excellent book. Agile Retrospectives is a more recent book, and it looks at how to do retrospectives for these short increments of work that we want to reflect on regularly. So it gives you exercises that you can do in these short periods. One of the benefits of using that book is that teams will just get bored or used to the things that you're doing with retrospectives, and so it fails to bring on reflection. So you need to change it up from time to time. This gives you a lot of resources for doing that. Fearless Change is a great book. If you consider yourself a change agent in the organization, this is an interesting book. You're familiar with design patterns. These are patterns for human interaction. These are patterns for dealing with the stresses of change in an organization. There's one that you've probably all done, and you didn't know it was a pattern. It's called Do Food. Anthropological studies have shown that people who eat together have different kinds of relationships. So celebrate your delivery. Bring in a cake. Go out for lunch. Leave some cookies on the table in the middle of the room. This is not cute. It's human. And it makes the workplace work in a different way. It's an interesting book. It includes a series of patterns for dealing with resistance constructively. Skeptics and so on. For example, if you've got a skeptic, who's intelligent and really doesn't believe that this is the right way to go, use them. Use them as a critic. Ask them if they will be a mirror for you on what you're doing. We're about transparency and making things visible. If you can get an early warning sign by somebody who's carefully scrutinizing what you're doing, why not? On the other hand, carefully scrutinizing what you're doing may show them more than if they're sitting with their arms folded in their office and saying those people are crazy. In order to learn, we also need to facilitate dialogue, a form of discussion that takes place when different contributions are considered in terms of the validity of the arguments rather than assessing them according to the power positions of the people who are speaking. Dialogue is there. A lot of the meetings that we have are trying to do this, get to the answer. They're trying to come in like this. And dialogue, the fact that we can't get there is because human beings first need to wander around in the ideas. And dialogue opens this up and brings more information in so that the team, which needs to self-organize and make these decisions, has proper information on which to then go and bring the meeting to a point, or perhaps bring it to a point in another meeting. Facilitation is really helpful to this because we have bad habits around how we meet together. I don't have to tell you about that. Facilitation can help to create a safe space for dialogue, because if I feel that by voicing dissent I'm going to be labeled in some way or that it will be disadvantaged to my career, I may not say anything, and the team is impoverished by my silence. My contribution then goes missing. A facilitator learns tricks and skills to make the space safe and help bring these things out, especially when you have people with different styles. Some people want to talk a lot. When those people are talking, other people will sit completely quiet. What do? There are skills you can learn. This is an excellent book, A Skilled Facilitator. It's a really big book with lots of skills in it, and you don't need them all. You can buy the book and find one that looks interesting for your situation and try it. Another is Collaboration Explained. That is not the cover of Collaboration Explained, which is specifically written for agile teams by Jean Tabaka from years of experience working as a facilitator and a coach. She's a trained IAF facilitator, by the way, and it looks at techniques, including some templates that you can use to try to make your meetings more collaborative. If you don't have time to learn all these skills, if you really need to get your team working together better because of some urgency, and if you have courage, you might want to try Software for Your Head instead and learn it together. Software for Your Head is also a book of patterns, and these are communication protocols. So in the same way that we use communication protocols between programs and machines, we can set up communication protocols that make it simpler and clearer for us to communicate with our teammates. The core protocols inside Software for Your Head, there are these 11 core protocols, and I won't go into them all. Some of you may have heard of the perfection game, which is a way to give constructive feedback. Ask for help is an interesting one. It's simply the team agrees together that it's okay to ask for help. And when I am asked for help, I must help you. That will change your interactions. Cuts down on the personality stuff. Like, why is everybody always asking me? Well, now I've committed that I'm willing to help. Now we figure out how to make that work. So I'll give you an example of one called the check-in protocol. Somebody comes to work and says, I'm checking in. I feel sad that I missed my son's first day of school today. And I feel mad that our product owner skipped our demo yesterday. And I'm in. So what happened there? A whole person came to work. Whether you acknowledge it or not, that whole person still comes to work. And if he's distracted and sad because his child was crying as he left the house and was going on their first day to school, then he may not be all there for the first part of the morning. It's just going to happen. So let's talk about who we are as human beings. And he's angry that the product owner who had made a promise to work with this team did not show up without warning at yesterday's demo. And I'm in. So, okay, I have these things going on, but I'm in. I'm committed to working together with you now. There's a choice involved. Treat people like grown-ups, right? This is somebody saying, I'm a grown-up. I'm in. The core protocols are available for free download. And This, I believe, is the correct link. There are two links there. If one doesn't take, somebody told me at my last talk that one link will and the other one might not take you there. The leader is meaning maker. When you have a surgeon, they know the meaning. And the surgeon will tell people what they need to do when they need to do it. But in a self-organizing team, if you want to get that productivity boost, you need people to know what's going on so they can make these real-time decisions and switches and surf the information that's coming in based on the facts. They need to have meaning for what they're doing. The leader can help them to know that there's meaning and remember what it is and step back and do their reflection with it. Why are we doing this again? If the meaning isn't there, it can help the team to realize the meaning isn't there and help them to find it. Go out into the organization. It's not always easy. Here's a tool you can use. It's in English. Well, it doesn't really look like English. FTSOW. For the sake of what? Simple question. Wofür, right? Why are we doing this again? This is a question that is a leadership question. And anybody can ask it. Okay, we've got down a rat hole. I know that this framework is important, but I'm not sure we need to talk about it at this level right now. Why are we doing this again? And help the team to both become efficient and effective. Another good tool is stated values. So your teams have values, whether you talk about them or not. Your organization may have values that come up on the screensaver or appear beside the front door. They may or may not be your team's values. Do you know what your team's values are? Can be really useful to create a list of values that's pulled from the team. It's not given to them. As a starting point for growing those values into alignment with the organization or influencing the organization with those values. Here's a list of values that I facilitated a group of managers who were wanting to improve Agile in their organization. These are the things they came up with, and it's really important that is created by the team themselves. If it isn't created by the team, you have no realistic basis from which to grow those values. And if values are handed to the team, they will still operate out of their real values anyway. And then you get these weird behaviors that don't match, incongruencies. Another way to do it is rather than with values, with behaviors. But behaviors are more prescriptive and shift over time. It's worth noting, values and behaviors shift over time. This needs to be a living document that's loosely held, that the team knows is theirs and that they need to maintain as things shift, that they're free to change it to reflect their reality and their desires. These core commitments are part of the core protocols that we saw earlier and may be useful to you as a way to explain how to create some agreements between the team. They needn't adopt all of those, but it might provide a model that will inspire them. Another place to model integrity, as I mentioned, is with regard to promises. Organizations generally have some kind of a pervasive discourse of overcommitment. It's so, well, we're overcommitted, but it has to be that way. We're overcommitted, but we're good. We can take it, you know, we've hired the best, and they seem to be doing fine working 12 hours a day. You know, it's all right. There are different discourses of overcommitment, and we don't talk about them because it would make us have to think about whether they're the right thing to do. It can help to surface those. Why are we doing this? For the sake of what are we working 10, 12 hours a day? Or whatever form of overcommitment we have. Maybe it's saying yes, 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 and then letting everything fall on the floor. I don't know if you saw one of the things in the exhibition downstairs is a big poster from an exercise that I facilitated with a team where it turned out that they had a big problem with saying yes to everything. And they actually thought it was more important to say yes to everything than it was to deliver everything they'd said yes to. They were in pain. Here's a tool that I've created, and it comes out of the world of coaching, for helping a team start to talk about making promises and what happens when they've made a promise and they can't deliver, what kind of conversations do they have, what's the relationship with their customer, is their customer fulfilling their role? You're free to use it if you like. It's not anywhere on the web yet, but it is in my slides. We have recreated coaching in Agile because we needed it, because the discourses around traditional management were not what we needed to work with these teams. And so The metaphor probably came from sports coaching. However, did you know that there is a 20-year-old discipline of coaching with its own body of knowledge, resources, certifications, excellent teachers, training programs, entire schools? There's a whole world of skill enhancement in that discipline that we can start to draw on. International Coaches Federation defines coaching as partnering with a client in a thought-provoking and creative process that inspires them to maximize their personal and professional potential. A lot of people got into leadership and management because they wanted to do that. And now there's more time. Coaches need to do things like listening and listening and listening, asking powerful questions, helping the team build their vision and values, and then reminding them of their goals, their vision and values, helping them to work through those things and keep them visible, helping the team learn. But if there's only one tool that you use, and this may be the only thing you take from this talk, try powerful questions. You remember when your parents used to say to you, "Did you do that thing I asked you to do?" You don't really want to answer that question. You know that question is loaded, and a lot of the questions that we ask at work contain the answer that we want to get back. So will that be ready on Friday? Appropriate answer is... These are closed-ended questions, and there's a better way. Because when we're asking these loaded questions, people tend to start to blame. When they're blaming or diverting attention off themselves, they're not in the state where you're going to get creative answers and deep thought. Pull these slides out of my Petra Kucha. They're still timed at 20 seconds. Isn't that interesting? So there's a better way. It comes from studying use of questions in multiple cultures. All right, stop that. And why comes out as the most powerful question you can use, followed by things like what and how. Although why needs to be done carefully, because why requires context and trust, because it can also provoke defensiveness. But a question like what or how, so rather than saying, why did we do that? Which, there's a lot of information in there other than the question and tends to provoke a reaction. You could say, what can we do to fix this? Which opens things up and is more likely to engage people and free them to do what needs to be done. Why did we do it that way? What would make this work better? See questions like that in retrospectives. Instead of, can I help? Which is not a bad question, but it's a yes-no question. And it's really easy for somebody to feel kind of guilty and say, no, it's okay, I'll finish it. What can I do to help? There's a sense there that there's an offer, an assumption that help is wanted, that I really do want to help. It's simply linguistic. It's something you can learn and practice. These questions are a lever that you can open people up with. If you've got a short lever, if you're trying to open this can with a quarter, you can only open it a crack, a quarter, a euro. If you've got a long lever, you can crack it right open and really get out what you need to get out. Ideas, creativity, answers, knowledge, expertise. So, we've looked at the leading as meaning maker, as a catalyst for growth, model of integrity, cultural change agent, and facilitator. I have some tools there that you could try. Wow, that was cool. I have never seen my computer do that before. It's a hint. Okay, I get it. So I'd like to tell you a story. What does Scrum have in common with the Mars Explorer robots? Jeff Sutherland, who's one of the co-creators of Scrum, in 1993, when the IBM report came out, was working with teams and doing methodologies and trying to help teams get better productivity. And when he saw the IBM report, his thought was, okay, granted, this works, but I know darn well that most organizations do not have a surgeon. And even those large organizations that may only have one or two. So how can we give ordinary teams the kind of productivity that they need in the absence of a surgeon? And he was looking for answers on that. At the same time, he was leasing space in his workshop to an MIT student doing some robotics research. And this guy's robot, this heat-seeking robot, was coming into Jeff's space and trying to crawl up his leg or whatever. And so he was asking some questions about what it did. And he learned about its subsumption architecture. Anybody know what that is? Can you tell me after? But he thought that was fascinating. And turned out what this was a new departure in artificial intelligence. It was a new departure in artificial intelligence. Up till this point, they had been trying to build artificial intelligence using massive databases and huge computing power. And what they'd managed to get out of that was a chess-playing computer. And they were not happy with that. So this was something different. Let me tell you what this was. It was just a little thing that looked like a bug. These guys are descended from them. It's the Mars Explorer robot. Six legs. In each leg, a processing unit. Computer. That knows how to walk. In the spine, a computer that knows how to coordinate the legs. No central processor on this baby. Just seven distributed processors. No database at all. Only sensors for real-time information coming in. And in the head, a neural chip that starts out blank. You put this thing down on the ground, and it teaches itself to walk like a toddler. It was fascinating. And this influenced how he built Scrum. And so this is an essential model that underlies everything that I've talked about you about here today. And that is that we need to believe that a team of ordinary individuals can reach extraordinary performance without telling them what to do. Scrum and many of the agile practices are based on that idea. Do you believe it? If you're a manager, do you believe that you can find ways to step aside and that they'll be all right? In fact, they might do things you could never have imagined. There's one more resource that I talk about in this talk, but I'm not going to look at it now. It's in the slides. The Leaderful Teams Model is a book that includes a diagnostic for looking at your own leadership style and your group, because it's a leadership followership model. You can't lead in a way that your followers aren't ready to handle. And then it includes ways to find the resources you need to grow in different areas of that model. If you like to work from theory, this book may be very interesting to you. So I had asked you to write down something interesting and something crazy. And if you haven't, take a second right now to do so, because I'm going to ask you to talk in pairs about what you found. Take a moment. Was that a question? No. Okay. So find somebody in the room, maybe the person you're sitting next to. It doesn't matter whether you know them or not. And we're going to do a thought experiment, which I believe is a term we got from the Germans, right? Thought experiment? So, this thing that you wrote that was interesting. The thought experiment is you have decided you're going to try this when you get back to work. Tell the other person what is your first step. When you've done that, switch. And if you run out of time, if you still have time left, take the thing that you thought was crazy, try to do the same experiment. You're going to, in some limited, careful way, try this thing. What would be your first step? Please. Share your ideas with one another. All right, come on back. Come on back. Thank you. You can continue that conversation over coffee. And thank you for your involvement. I can take one or two questions. And then it would be great if you would take a moment to fill out the feedback sheet to help me know what worked for you and how I can improve this. Also for the organization of the conference to know what you think. Questions? Comments? Arguments?
Discussions, crazy things. When you prepared that talk, what was your personal aha experience in there?
I really had one. And it was that the WaveWriter model changed the way I made this presentation. I was in Sweden. It was the night before. I'd been working on it for about 6 weeks. I still didn't have my talk down. I had too much information. I didn't know what to include. However, I had previously decided that what I would do in order to prepare for this talk was to focus on what I care about and what my audience cared about and find the intersection of those things. The night of the talk, I woke up at like 3 a.m. or something, and the talk was there. I knew how it, I had all the slides. I could have, you know, just thinned them out and given it, but I had something that really had coherence, I felt. It wasn't this. It has improved since. But still, I surfed it. So I collected the information I needed. And information was coming in from different places, and I was learning things at the conference. Linda was there. I got all this input from Linda the day before. And the whole thing came together and created what I needed when I needed it. And it transformed how I trust myself in making a presentation. And it transformed why I'm up here. Thanks for asking. Yes?
Another question. I asked myself how far this idea of team empowerment and self-organization should go. Give you one example. Do you think it would be a good idea to ask the team to organize the compensation, the money compensation, salary within the team? Do you have any experience on that?
How far should we go with self-organization? Would it be a good idea, for example, just get, we're being taped, so would it be a good idea, for example, to ask the team to organize their compensation? The answer is always it depends. That's what managers are paid for, is to figure out whether it's a good idea to do things now.
It wasn't
So, let me tell you that you need to have criteria about what's appropriate when. Mm-hmm. If you want something formal, go to the Raelynn book. But a key thing when dealing with self-organization is don't fix it if it ain't broke. Let it come from the team. If you can spot that you're, and I've seen this, if you can spot that your compensation scheme is causing people to compete with one another rather than collaborate, a powerful question can surface the issue. And if the team feels that that's something that's important enough to look at now, they may talk about it now, or it may go under and it may come out later. But if it comes from the team, it will have more power, and they will have then what they need to make the case to management to ask for a change. They may need help knowing how to do that. They may not have those skills. But the timing is always according to the team, because otherwise you're taking your agenda and putting it on the team. The team may be more concerned right now with getting better requirements from their customer. That may be the thing that they need to work on. And they need to make mistakes. So you may be able to clearly see that there's something going on, and if you cannot get the team to acknowledge it, time isn't right yet.
You mentioned just that you had this idea of what if we would organize the meeting like open space and just people who are interested are coming and others who don't want to. Did you try this? Do you have any experience?
Ilya's tried it. And are you coming tomorrow?
No.
You can try it at another conference. There's lots of open space going on in Europe. What happens is that people behave like adults.
No, I know what I know. I've
you've seen open space.
Okay. I thought like transferring this idea into an organization and like suggesting, okay, what if we do have a meeting, we have this some people are invited and then some are required, some are optional. So if you just like put it out that we have this meeting, this topic, this is the agenda, whoever.
Okay.
That they can contribute. Did you try this in your organization? That was.
I've seen it happen spontaneously in an organization, and it was quite lovely to see. However, Ilya has done it intentionally in an organization. Well, it actually happened spontaneously in that case, too. However, it was actually agreed upon by the employees. So I'd suggest if you would like to listen to that Petra Kucha and ask Ilya, you'll be speaking to somebody who has recently actually seen how that works in an organization. Our time is up. Thank you very much.